Several different topics have been drawn together in order to suggest some of the different images of Jesus that surround us. And it's my conviction that these images of Jesus all in one way or another have some reflections and implications for the presence of Christ in our midst and the work of Spirit. The series started on Monday, and we did Who is the Jesus of the Jesus Seminar. The series will continue on Friday, and I will do Who is the Jesus of the Quran, because the Muslim community has a distinct Jesus story and image of Jesus that comes out of their scriptures. And then on Saturday I want to do Who is Jesus in John, and go back to the Christian scriptures and show and do something about the individuality of that picture of Jesus and some of the problems it presents for Christians. This series grows out of several concerns, which I want to just mention at the beginning. One is my conviction that there is some use, or there's some clarification that comes from laying out something of the whole Jesus process. We actually are surrounded by a number of different images of Jesus. There are a number in the New Testament. The way in which, if you were to dramatize each of the four Gospels, you would have different kinds of movies. He was just telling about one of the other films that was done. When did you say it was done?
Probably in the late 60s.
Called The Gospel According to St. Matthew, which is just simply taking the text of the Gospel according to Matthew and dramatizing it. And it was a very different Jesus than most people who read the Gospel of Matthew had gotten.
Right. It was done by Pasolini, who was an Italian communist. And it has a very Marxist flavor. Very, very interesting.
And of course, the most of the edges, prophetic edges of Jesus' preaching and behavior are normally toned down in our congregations as we focus on the more of the comfort and more of the security that God gives us in Christian experience. So that it seems to me that the Spirit enables these reflections to mediate some kind occasion and mediate some self-understanding and deeper insights, whether or not the refraction of Jesus is exactly like the New Testament or not. So I'm basically suggesting that these images, the various Jesus's function as part of the process of the Spirit bringing to our awareness and nudging our experience to take experiences of grace and use them in our life and culture. The second thing that I'm concerned about is what I would call the prophetic ministry of Christians. I'm interested in Christian ethics and how Christians use the historical Jesus and images of Jesus to form styles of living and rituals of living, and that in some sense differentiate and in some sense challenge the culture in which we live. Put it another way, one of the spirit processes that the Jesus figures help us to do is to discover the sins that we need to repent of. The church has I think fairly frequently falls in the habit of repenting of our grandparents' sins. And in a sense, imagining the sins which are no longer problems. This is one of the examples that's important for me. I think that one of the key things in our world is violence. Sexual violence, the violence of war, the structural violence that we do to people and to the earth. And there's a great deal of hullabaloo about great deal of discussion and a great deal of Christian energy focused on matters like abortion, homosexuality, certain kind of sexual lifestyle that simply do not get at the enormous amount of violence in our world. When all is said and done, much of the sexual violence in our world is done by heterosexual men to women. And this does not cause it's in a sense done a lot of damage to the image of the male in our society, but it just doesn't make it into the front pages, and you don't have people worrying about that in the same way. So anyhow, you'll see. Tomorrow night there's going to be a discussion of the death penalty, and that's another kind of violence that's important in our society. So I'm interested in the way that these images of Jesus prod us and alienate us and help us to address the ethical questions of the Christian life. The third concern is with the picture of Jesus, the human Jesus, the historical Jesus. In my experience, many people have a Jesus formula and are concerned about the godness of Jesus, they're concerned about the doctrine of Jesus, and there isn't a strong sense of the Jesus story and the figure of Jesus. And so I think that many of these images of Jesus help us to recover a sense of the humanity of Jesus, which is important for our spirituality, for our discipleship. The Jesus of history is somebody we have in common with both Jews and Christians. And it seems to me this is a time and place where some of the things we share with other people in this world need to be talked about, as well as some of our differences. We need boundaries between communities, but we don't need high chain electrified fences between communities. Put it in another way, theologically, I am intrigued by and nurtured by a theology of the cross, a kenotic theology that comes out of Philippians, in which the real issue for Christians is not how Jesus is divine, but how God is human. So that the humanity of God is becomes for Christians the central concern rather than the divinity of Jesus. And I think that's another way of going about using the experience of early Christians to nurture the gospel. Okay, let's get on with the movie. I just want to again emphasize that there are two general strategies for telling a Jesus story. One is the story of doing a modern version of Jesus set in Palestine. The other is the way in which this film was done, and that was to do a Jesus look-alike, to do a figure in the modern period which has all kinds of allusions to biblical references and so on. And there are other examples of this. The story that I like a great deal is a novel by the Japanese novelist Yusaku Endo called Silence, in which you have a 16th century missionary priest who is really trying very hard. It reminds me of Murder in the Cathedral. He's trying very hard to become a martyr, and the story of whether he does or doesn't has a lot of analogies to, again, Jesus look-alike allusions, and so on. You know what it dawned on me, Sarah, that this sort of preoccupation with literature and the arts, and there are many ways in which artists and poets and musicians and so forth are some of the troublers of our consciences and so forth. You always led book discussions at 4 o'clock in Chalet 3 about literature. And the last one I remember was Equus.
Yeah.
And so that this business of finding the way in which these voices in our culture, and you know, time after time I'll go to the theater and say, well, that was a better sermon than I heard in church. In terms of the way it confronts you to think about what the tragedy and so forth in our own culture. Okay. The other thing about the genre of film in particular, the prophets had two ways of experiencing the voice of God. One was auditions. They heard things and spoke words, had oracles. The other was visions. Now, the interesting thing about movies is that they are both, there are words, but there's visual imagery. And I am persuaded, I'm fairly well convinced that much of the carrier of our religious symbols is in images. And many of the deep impressions in our life are in images. I think there are two images from Holden that are probably the key metaphors for my spirituality, and one of them is the path up the mountain, the whole notion of a journey, the visualization of the nature of a journey, and the other is the creek. That rushing water of the creek is, for me, tells me more about the work of the Holy Spirit than an awful lot of books I've read. And so that there are powerful, powerful, and our images are being formed in this culture heavily by the media. They're being formed heavily by the media. And I'm quite sure that my students bring into class the vernacular, the experiential vernacular from the films they see, and I'm sure that people bring to church with them the vernacular from their general culture, and that they, in some sense, only hear what they can hear. I am 33 years of teaching have convinced me that students do not hear what I think I say. They hear what they hear. And it's very illuminating when you read the blue books to find out what they hear and what they make of it and what they do with it. And it's quite amazing that they hear anything sometimes, you know. But I'm not. So, but I really do think we have to attend more to communication as a process in which the receiver is already coded. You already have the categories of experience that will appropriate whatever kind of things are said and so on. Anyhow, film. Okay, Jesus of Montreal. I'm going to open it up and ask you what was important for you in the film. I'm going to suggest that probably what enables the recognition are the biblical allusions. And I am fascinated by which biblical allusions kind of grab people. We were talking about it the other night, and that was one of them, and somebody else had another one. And so I'm interested in that. I'm interested in your impressions of the Jesus figure. How is Jesus characterized? What is it that makes that figure moving or the plot moving? And where's the conflict? Okay, what did you see in the film?
Well, a couple things. I was real impressed in the beginning in the selecting of the cast. When Jesus is looking for his other players, obviously the disciple figures are very earthy people. And when you conceive fishermen, you know, the typical kind of crude language and that kind of thing, it's very interesting. He's picking there, and he's picking the Mary Magdalene figure. You know, there was a whole lot of continuity there with the gospel story. And then the other thing that really struck me was the relationship that the Jesus figure had with the church. And in the beginning, the church really blessing him and encouraging him to kind of stretch the boundaries, but as soon as they saw what the product was, you know, quickly coming to quash it. And very, very reminiscent of the gospel story.
So that the religious authorities in the gospel then become the contemporary religious authorities.
Right.
Do you think there's any point to the picking of actors? Does the fact that they're actors mean anything? Well, just let that question percolate. What other things in the movie were important for you?
Well, one scene that struck me quite strong was when he's up in the skyscraper with the lawyer, you know, and he's essentially tempting him with riches and power. And even the photography at one point, you know, the city sort of looks barren and like a wilderness, and then all of a sudden comes into focus.
So the skyscraper is the modern temple spire.
I was thinking of it more in terms of being in the wilderness and being...
Oh. But remember that vision, one of them, he takes him up into the top and shows him all the kingdoms of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a pretty, pretty look-alike temptation.
Well, of course, the turning of the table in the temples was, you know, when he goes in and turns the... Was it in the hospital or where?
Well, there were temples of commerce.
Oh, the advertising agency. Yeah. And turning that, you know.
Advertising agency, and what was the other issue in that scene? What triggered it?
Well,
exploitation.
The exploitation of the model and the
kind of like a slave market or something.
Yeah.
And then driving him out of the temple. So, I mean, it's very interesting that the advertising agency is the temple, you know, in this film, that there's also a lot of overtones there of what we're worshiping.
Well, commerce is our religion.
Yeah.
In this country.
Well, now, how do you put that, how do you put together the observation that in the one case he seemed to be, there seemed to be conflict with the priests and the church, and in the other case it seemed to be conflict with the advertising business? What's the connection? What's the connection?
I don't think he's going to let either institution off at all.
Is there any connection between, is there?
Well, isn't the church, I don't know, but.
Well, a film is a film.
The church is, this play, isn't it, I mean, it's a passion play, but isn't it sort of a fundraiser?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't it make money?
The church,
huh?
Sure.
I don't know whether that's how much you
can
find, but
there is some hint that the way in which the church appeases wealth is the problem for the church. So that the economic, again,
the board of trustees that he had to answer.
Right.
To.
Yeah. It seems to me that there's a very strong image of business as relating to Romans, and business is relating to the Roman Empire.
Mm.
They're the realists, they're the hard-nosed, practical, this is the way life is people.
Mm.
And then the church is the Pharisees.
Mm.
And we have the, you know, we have the poor, pathetic Jews in, you know, Jesus' time who had these strange religious habits and they didn't make any sense to the hard-nosed practical Romans. It doesn't make any sense to the hard-nosed practical, it's just business folks, as represented in the movie.
Mm.
And then we have our Pharisees, whether they're disillusioned or not in the church, they have to get along with the Romans or the business folks. That's the way it seems to me, and very obvious too.
Any other parts of the, any other of the illusions? Been talking a lot about the conflict.
The one that I couldn't figure out is where the, you know, he comes back to the house and the priest has been out in bed with the one woman. And I couldn't, there must have been some illusion there, but I couldn't put my hand on it.
Do you mean his relationship with her? Or a particular scene?
Well, how that related to the Jesus story. You know, basically the gospel that it follows.
So the popularity of Jesus with all those folks when he was playing the part, you know, I mean, they were just taken by his...
Charisma.
Charisma, right.
And very, very interesting crowd scenes, weren't they?
Yeah, the other scene was when the subway came, you know, and there was these people, not that they were paying any attention to him in particular, but they were just gone, you know. I don't know if that's a flashback to desertion or...
Did you catch the illusion in the subway scene? What
no.
The, where the speech in the subway scene came from? Yeah, Mark 13, the desolation, and then the next part of that. That's just before the place where it talks about the Son of Man coming in power and great glory.
Well, after you say that, about that illusion, I was curious, I was thinking about the portrayal of the Jesus figure, and the, I guess, you know, it's just a general illusion. But he was portrayed through most of the film, with the exception of the scene where he's in the advertising. He, you know, chased them out of the temple there. He's portrayed as very, I don't know if he's, if passive is the right word, but you know, he's quiet. He's extremely soft-spoken. He's gentle and you know, soft face, and just, I mean, very childlike in many ways.
But he's also very sure of himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that comes through.
Yeah.
Kind of to do the play one last time, whether, I mean, the authorities said very clearly, you can't do it. but he doesn't do it in a forceful, I mean, in a violent way, but it's a very self-assured, we're just going to do it. But it was gentle,
yeah,
even in how he did that.
I think you're onto something now. How do they picture that he can anger, you know, this fairly mild male is able to arouse the anger that he does in the priests and stir up the crowd? What is it that gets the attention of the crowd? How does he rewrite the play? Because it comes off in the play not as very mild. He comes off in the play as a very harsh critic of the society. Remember the speeches in the play?
Yeah.
And what goes on in those speeches? What is it that he's... How has he modernized the dialogue that causes all this trouble?
Well, he seems
because you couldn't, you know, you saw him off stage and you wouldn't think this guy would hurt anybody.
Yeah. But when he's the actor, he seems to, when he's, you know, portraying Jesus as the actor, he seems a lot more, I guess, you know, I don't know if divine is like the right word, but he seems more the authoritative figure, and he seems to really put the emphasis from that position. He then puts the emphasis back on the people, and like really emphasize
that
role.
I don't think divine is the best word. I think if somebody can come up with another word, I think it would be... Well, keep looking for it, because I think there's a better... I think there probably is a better way to characterize those speeches in the Passion Play.
Prophetic.
Yeah, they're very prophetic in the sense they're very critical. They're kind of radical speeches about the betrayal of the leadership of the society and the institutions. So this very mild person says some very harsh things.
Well, he says it with authority, and that's what elevates it from after-dinner conversation, where that sort of thing takes place a lot, to something that's very disturbing, because he does speak with such authority as though he'd gone around opening closets and said, look what I found, and I have a right to tell you.
The authority is what authority? When he's doing the script, what is his authority?
Well, it's not divine yet.
Well, I mean, he's really doing the script. He's really just modernizing the Passion script.
So
it's not his, it's not exactly his message that he made up.
It's
he
God's
just
message.
Tried to understand it.
Yeah.
He's working for the church.
What?
He's working for that church or that institution that wants to put on the play. So they gave him the script.
He rewrote it.
Yeah, he basically freshened it up, which is to make it contemporary.
So whose script was it then?
Which gospel did it come from? Did you catch the allusion that tells you which gospel it came was based on?
Yeah, St. Mark's Gospel.
Yeah, St. Mark's. Mm-hmm. Other, what
is that
we're doing?
The one that rejected him?
That's the one.
Actually, I found that almost a Good Samaritan sequence there, because the first hospital was too full, had nothing to do with him. The second, okay, he was there, but everybody just kind of ignored him. Mm-hmm. And then the third one, that was the Jewish hospital,
where they spoke
took
English,
him in, gave him the greatest care, pulled out everything that was needed and so forth, took care of all of his needs.
There was almost a resurrection scene there in the hospital where
he was
presumed dead, and then suddenly...
Well, he was brain dead.
Yeah.
Well, before
that, when he got up, I left the emergency room, just walked out and looked like...
Well, the emergency room was like a scene from hell with all the people, you know, sitting around sort of in despair and not being taken care of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lou, you're way back in the corner. You don't want to have a back seat.
Well, I just want to intrude when I came in late.
That's all right.
After his death, you were just mentioning the chaos and confusion, which could be the first and second day, but on the third day, I found that I was kept looking for a resurrection scene. I thought maybe he was going to rise from his gurney there, but maybe he wasn't brain dead after all. But I found that the resurrection was beautifully encapsulated by his organ donations. And they showed the man who got his heart, a woman who could see with her eyes. And this, to me, represented resurrection very, very strongly.
That's interesting, because I see that when you say it, and yet I thought that it was him healing, that was his ultimate act of healing that he gave himself and people lived.
Oh,
actually,
I just thought
the
resurrection
body
healing is the ultimate healing.
Well, I saw the resurrection when he left the emergency room and he seemed to be suddenly doing well again and wept with the two women, just as found Christ. And then he died, or he left.
He should have been hospitalized with concussion. He shouldn't have been dismissed like that.
One of the things that makes a piece of art valuable and significant is its depth, its ability to spawn different kinds of perception in different people. So that it's really quite fascinating to hear you draw in different kinds of allusions. And I think you're right, Sarah, that nothing in the film ever made it more than the story. Literally, taken literally, it's simply the story of an actor who gets way too involved in his script. And nothing that happens in the story, the actual modern story, is other than the story of an actor and what could have happened, what might have happened. So it's a very intriguing that it pulls in for us all these biblical allusions.
Well, another thing, when the policeman arrested him, you have the one centurion at the cross making his confession. You know, I liked what you said, you know, as he's putting the cuffs on him, he's still saying, you know, hey, what you said was really important.
You had asked the other night about the opening scene, which was, yeah, John the Baptist.
Oh.
Even to the point of the scruffiness of that role, and then where he said, pointed to this critic and said, now there's a really good actor. You know, there's the person that's gonna follow me, who's much better. But from that moment then, the Jesus figure was always in white.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I haven't noticed that yet. I'll watch the next time.
Also his name of David, of course.
Daniel.
No, David, the actor. Was David?
It was Daniel.
Daniel. Sorry.
Columbo.
Yeah.
Sarah said something. I think we missed the organ transplant.
Oh, I just, in some ways, it just the giving of the body.
This is my body.
Yeah, given for you. Sacrificial lamb.
Maybe the very fact that the storyline is so simple and non-miraculous is what makes it so disturbing. So I found it disturbing, and I have changed my approach to disturbing things. Instead of running away from them, I tend to walk into them and find out why they bother me. And this bothered me precisely because it was so ordinary. This, I can't be perfect like the Jesus I've heard about in church. I can't walk on water. I can't behave all the time. But I sure could get into the kind of trouble that guy got into. And I sure could see myself ending up dead over it. And I sure could see myself as an organ donor in some stupid accident where I was trying to get a message across to people. And I personally think that that's what's so upsetting about it. And I'm sure that that was deliberate on the part of the director and producer and scriptwriter, is that this is a completely possible thing that you could go and do. And nobody's going to like it. They won't like it in church because they're going there for comfort. And we want the problems to be distant. And we want the reality to be distant. And we really want God to be distant in a way, unless he's going to be friendly. And that sure seems to be the way it's portrayed in terms of business, too. But if you could go and stand in court and say, I have no defense, and put aside all of your practicality, and you could say, I'm going to say this because it's true, and I don't care if I lose my job or you lose yours, and this is horribly offensive, and set aside all the life insurance and all those issues. Well, I don't want to do that either. And that, of course, is why it's so disturbing.
Columbo is a fairly ordinary person.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right, so am I.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's a fairly ordinary person, and all of a sudden he has a little bit of spunk.
Oops.
Huh?
Yeah, and he gets into all kinds of trouble.
And he gets into all kinds of trouble because he sort of says what he thinks or acts out the script the way he understands it.
Well, see, that's what's also disturbing. It isn't even his script. He's just starting to ask questions and starting to be affected by the story. It's someone else's story. He doesn't even know that it's
supposing we really got into the Jesus script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we started getting into that part.
Yeah.
So,
sounds dangerous. Sounds risky to me.
Is there... sometimes I wonder if the emphasis on the divinization of Jesus and the idealization of Jesus really protects us.
Oh, sure.
It distances Jesus from... It keeps Jesus as a distance. Whereas I'm wondering whether the incarnation, if as the church thinks, God was rather deeply involved in Jesus, then the ordinariness of Jesus is fairly important to that strategy. Lou?
Did you not ask a while back why people were so disturbed at his behavior? And it occurred to me, because he was speaking the truth and telling them things that they perhaps deep down felt guilty about, and yet acted another way, so it made them angry that they should hear the truth from him when they were trying to circumvent it or avoid it. That could account for their anger.
Okay. That was pretty interesting. More comments on the sort of your response to this whole Jesus figure. Not just the incidents, but the characterization that he...
I only saw the first half of the movie, but something else, just in this conversation, made me think about, you know, the humanity of Jesus and the ordinariness of Jesus as this actor, as the person who's, you know, doing the play, and how, you know, Jesus was just sort of, Jesus was really just being true to who he thought he was and spoke the truth as he thought the truth was. Did he, you know, we've made him into God, did he think of himself in that way at all? You know, I don't really think he did myself. But to think of him as so ordinary and being just just speaking the truth that came from within him, you know, to me it's a real, it says to me how dangerous it is for me to speak the truth that comes from within me, and I haven't dared to do it very often, really. I mean, really, to go up against, to say things that might cause other people to, you know, have, and how Jesus is an example, and to make it personal for me, of being who you are, truly who you are in the world, and how difficult that really is, and how life-threatening.
So you thought the figure of Jesus as one who exposed a certain kind of integrity and coherence of him, of himself.
Well, from some of that from the conversation,
sure,
too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and almost a naivety about it, too. It's like, well, this is, you know, this is just sort of what seems right to me, and I just got to sort of do it, because, and you know, I mean, I'm not willing to do that like he would, or like, certainly like Jesus was.
Well, I think that the Jesus figure or character, or the actor, was charismatic. I mean, and he clearly was a leader, which not everyone is. I mean, he's an organizer. He certainly had people. He got his disciples together in a way, and they were very loyal and very, I mean, they're interesting people too.
It was,
you
like
know,
he
and
had
how a, they supported him.
It was like he had a power behind himself that, I mean, just walked up and those people just took off and followed him.
Yeah,
it was more than
me,
just
basically,
his.
There they were, you know. I found his gentle strength very appealing. I found it a little. Sometimes he reminds me of the way I think Jesuses are portrayed.
Mm.
You know,
a bit too
gentle.
Come
on, guy. I mean, I like his temple scene pretty well, but I thought he was a little too much for me.
Jesus in the Gospel according to St. Matthew was much more rigorously prophetic than this figure. Although this figure is certainly very provoking and very, very oracular and provoking of hostility and any thinking about why they're actors? Go ahead.
No, this isn't that.
Go ahead.
I thought you were.
You first.
Okay. This is more a question than anything else. It seems to me that it might be significant that the establishment that he was overturning when he got in trouble was the advertising industry, which, if there's anybody in our society that's responsible for sort of creating false idols or helping to shape the community myths, the untrue myths of our society, would be the advertising world. So did anybody else think that was significant that they picked that particular, he could have picked the oil industry or, you know, the legal
industry. The church.
Huh?
Could have picked the church.
He did pick the church, too.
True.
The church and advertising were the two institutions that I saw him challenge, but I thought the advertising was.
But in terms of creating images.
The advertising goes closer to people's souls than most other industries.
I think that they work on your psyche and they shape the whole culture, really.
When the last time I saw it, I was trying to put together why in the world is it the church and the advertising agency? And I picked up a couple of lines. To me, it suggested that the critique was not of the industry in and of itself or the church in and of itself, but the way in which those industries give in to financial interests and compromise a potential integrity for the sake of what sells in the one case or who the supporters are in, so that in a way the corrupting influence was the economic power. That's not so different than the new than the new Jesus research, which sees Jesus as a peasant, a lower class person from Galilee, which is confronting the more wealthy establishment in Jerusalem. So that the, in other words, the issue of economic power and the use of economic power and the exploitation that economic power can do to institutions which have other potential sources of integrity and conscience.
Now, in the biblical temple scene, these animals and birds and whatever are being sold. I mean, there's a commercial, thing going on there too, financial to make money for the temple. And so there's certainly a connection between
the towns. It certainly fits that
theme. And it's also, in that context, it's a misrepresentation of what the church really should be, whereas in many cases, advertising is a misrepresentation of what it's supposed to be advertising.
I think that's well said.
Picking up on the actor angle, it's
good,
interesting
good.
That he was an actor.
Why?
First of all, I wanted to say, point one is that it's interesting he was an actor turning against his own in the advertising agency. Because in theory, as part of the Actors Guild and in that group, then he should have had respect for the industry. I think that it has to do with story point two about why they're actors, that it's common for our species to, we live in stories, we don't think about our own stories, we tell stories, we don't think about what they all mean, and we're all caught up in them for a long time. We go along and don't even realize it's our own life. It's as though we're living something that's been programmed at us, and if we're very fortunate, we might wake up and say, hey, this is my life, and who else is going to be living it for me? And then the real story comes through. So it's as though you're reading woodenly along the script, reading woodenly along in Holy Writ, wherever you're trying out for a part, and then you realize that it's not just a part, that it's the whole thing, and there you are center stage. So I find it profound that they were actors representing this major story, and then the story devoured them.
Any other comments on the actors? That's pretty interesting.
Just to add to what Deanne said and kind of make a parallel, she mentioned that as an actor he was kind of turning against the advertising was kind of turning against what he was involved in the same way Jesus kind of turning against in the temple. As a prophet, he was, supposedly went along with the church, and yet he was going against by coming in and turning the tables.
I think there was an element of the integrity of the play and the integrity of acting. That the acting, that they were asking, in some sense, actors to be less than they could be. I think also that maybe actors are marginals. They really don't have any place to lay their head.
Mm-hmm.
These are pretty transient, poor. The number of people that really make a living on the arts is relatively small. And certainly in acting, we all know people who have knocked themselves out for 10 or 15 years and then decided to do something else for their bread and butter and do music or theater or something else as their avocation, because they just can't raise a family on it.
That seemed to be echoed in the way that the security guard, the attendant, would direct them around. That was like the air that he gave. That was like, okay, next scene. He had some kind of like, that seemed to like reflect that, I think. That didn't really mean it wasn't just, it was just kind of a show, like a circus, some kind of circus act or something, that seemed to be worth more.
One of the things I identified with, that this may be something different than some of you, but having just retired, and I have realized how many ways in which my job enhanced my gifts and resources. how in many ways the script made something of me that I would not have been, and the community made something of me that I would not have been by myself. And so I was intrigued with the idea that the script, the passion script, made something significant out of this actor that he would not have been if he didn't have a script that was larger than himself. That somehow we have self-resources, but that we don't often write a script that stretches them the way that some scripts do.
I have a couple of questions. I just need some help. The women at the beginning and the women at the end. The one thing I'd seen this film years ago, but the main thing I remembered was the music.
Oh.
The women scene.
Yes.
Which comes about much better on the big screen than it does on the small. But I don't.
Incredibly
I
lovely
understand it.
Music.
Oh, I mean, those incredible voices.
And there again, you know, that here they were at the beginning recording this thing and obviously didn't make much, because then here they were at the end singing with their boombox and their cigar box out there.
What I want to know is, were the two women that were the actresses?
I thought about that at the end too. Were they at least a symbol, or were they the same women?
Were they the same women? And was that the way they found to some authentic way of continuing the story?
No, I didn't have that sense.
I had that sense this time at the end, but
I'm not sure either. They look so different with their hair grown out. And
why were they, clearly in the subway, they had somehow been, it seemed to me, moved by whatever had happened. They had known, or
and it was in the subway.
It affected. So we're in that subway with that photo behind them, with their boombox. You know,
did you
maybe given up a career? I don't.
Did you recognize the music?
Yeah, well, from years ago, I remember there being more of the music in the film. It's the Stabat Mater by Pergolesi.
Okay.
It's extremely beautiful piece of music.
Well,
Stabat Mater by Pergolesi.
I remember that it's
Mary standing by the foot of the cross.
Yeah.
Is what Stabat Mater is.
I kind of remember them singing more of it.
I do too.
In the original film. That may have been cut out of the video copy. Yeah. It's a shame.
Are you saying that the women at the end who sang were not the same as the actresses earlier in the play within the film?
No, we were wondering if they weren't. We were thinking that they probably might have been the same.
Well, I just assumed they were.
Okay. Well, now we got three votes. Anybody else make that connection?
Well, why were they singing?
Why would they change women at that point?
I think there's a connection, whether it's the same particular people of the two women, the two symbolically, somewhere. I mean, it just reminded me of the two women that had been a part of the acting, of part of that life, and had been moved and transformed by that life. And somehow these women at the end, whether they were or not, as actresses, had been something that happened to them.
That you mean the ones that were singing the Stabat Mater?
Yeah.
And they were the same ones that were in the play?
I think they were meant to be. They may have been different because they had better voices or something.
Oh, you can dub them.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Well, we saw all that dubbing in the beginning of the film anyway.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
I thought that too. That's
also,
funny.
That scene, I wondered if that was kind of, you know, when the church essentially went underground after the death of Jesus was being symbolized. Because they were in the subway station.
It's interesting, though, the way in which the traditional high art then symbolizes a certain authentic continuity that could not be accomplished, was not marketed.
Yeah. Well, because the other thing at the end of the movie that struck me was the suggestion that they start a theater company in his name,
yeah.
And talking about continuing this avant-garde type of plays, and I thought, you know, with the start of Christianity, I mean, that was avant-garde what was there, and, you know, his disciples carrying it on, you know, after the time.
It's certainly from it seems to me that's another piece in the argument that it is raising the question of how institutions, whether it's advertising or church, sell out to economic interests. And, any more comments on the figure of Jesus? And the characterization of Jesus? Gentle, firm, gets into the script, very provoking, prophetic, awakens all sorts of responses.
Now, at one point, when he was going through the description of Jesus, he talked about him being a son of a Roman soldier from 6 BC.
Right.
And I don't know, I was wondering if that was tied to any of the new Jesus research.
I don't think it's anything to do particularly with the Jesus seminar, but there has been, particularly from some feminist scholars, some attempt to say either Joseph is the father of Jesus or somebody else is. And so the discussion of when you get into the humanity of Jesus, then you are going to portray that or think about that in contemporary terms in another way than an anomaly, which is what the virgin birth story proposes. Let's see, we really need to wind the formal part of this down. How does this film compare to other Jesus films that you've seen? How many of you have seen Last Temptation? Okay, how many of you have seen Jesus Christ Superstar? Okay, what's your reaction? And is this a stronger film? Are there negatives in this film? How do the other films look by comparison? In other words, ultimately, if we pursued this conversation, we would be looking for criteria so we could understand the strength of a film and the weakness of a film. Any analogy, it's very important that we understand where the strength of the analogy is and what isn't analogous. Otherwise, the analogy is a basis for a great deal of abuse. Anyhow, any reactions in comparison of this to other films?
Well, this one just seems so much more profound.
Why?
And thought-provoking. Well, because of all the analogies, and then, at least in my mind, near analogies that don't quite line up yet.
Okay.
There's things to kind of chew on for a while.
Jesus Christ Superstar was more of a musical, and there's more analogies in auditory speaking. And
more literal analogy.
Literalism, yeah.
How did you respond to the two films?
I would respond more favorably to the analogies of this film.
Why?
I think because I'm not basically an artist. Mm-hmm. I'm more artistic, more into music. I might see Jesus Christ Superstar more. Mm-hmm. I would understand it more. But it's been so long, it's hard for me to remember. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Jesus Christ Superstar, but my guess is that it was a little more blatant is the wrong term, but more open, whereas it was more subtle in the film we saw. And I think subtlety, I'm more interested in subtlety than I am having to throw in my face and very literal, which is why I haven't seen the Jesus Christ Superstar. I'm afraid it's too literal.
I don't know that I'd describe it that way. I think that it's more entertaining. I enjoyed it more. I enjoyed Jesus Christ Superstar, and I did not enjoy this movie.
Why?
Because it was disturbing, which brings me to the first comment I made. And of course, that was ordinary, and then we get into the whole I'm ordinary thing, and I don't like that. I see Jesus Christ Superstar again. That one, Jesus of Montreal, that'll stick with me. I don't need to see it again to retain the effect.
Yes, I think this Jesus was more disturbed. Yeah.
I think that this film puts us more face to face with who Jesus was or who he might have been, because it's in our context. And I think it gives us a better idea of what the people who lived in Jesus' time felt when they were approached by him, kind of questioning, you know, this guy is saying some things that kind of makes sense, but it's a little bit off the wall. And, you know, is he a prophet, or is he just an ordinary guy who's a little off his rocker? And I think the ways that we question kind of those, the things that the actor was doing in this film are maybe some of the same ways that people looked at Jesus in Jesus' time. And I think it helps us relate better to, because it's in the context of our own time period, I think it helps us to relate better to those initial reactions of not being quite sure what to think of this radical thing.
If you put it in our own cultural vernacular, we can really understand it more clearly. One more comment, and then I want to end the tape pretty quick.
Well, it seems to me the whole film in some ways is not so much comparing to other films, but challenges the divinity of Christ, or at least questions it, because it's like this film and the play within it portrays a way that a prophetic person could have a following and die. And I mean, it portrays a very real way that a fairly ordinary, powerful prophetic person could have a following. And maybe that's how it happened in Jesus' time. And raises questions about the resurrection. Because there's not I thought now, it would be unrealistic, but what if the Jesus of Montreal appeared to the women, you know, in some really miraculous way? That would have seemed really unreal, but more like the Bible portrays it.
Except Mark doesn't portray it that way.
Yeah,
it's exactly the way Mark.
That's what Mark says.
We'll talk about this after we end the tape, but I just want to say it either challenges the divinity of Jesus or it challenges our understanding of the divinity of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Or it may challenge our traditional understandings of resurrection. So there's something in the radical humanization of the figure that challenges some of our traditional theological perspectives. I want the line I want to use to sort of end it up is that the formal part is that it is pretty clear that the historical Jesus was a disturbing figure. You don't get rid of people who are milquetoasts. You don't create a new movement out of somebody who fits in and does the right thing. So that one of the, I think, helpful hints as to how to read the text, say, of Mark more perceptively comes from seeing these more radicalized figures of Jesus? Because it seems to me that there's nothing bad in it. We are not malicious in our domesticizing of Jesus. We have been moved, we have been touched by stories and by experiences of Christ in the church, so it's not unnatural that we would put halos around his head and have flowers around him and remember our fairly provocative parents with tenderness. But what they did was because of their disturbing, their strangeness, their weirdness, their controversialness, and so it in some ways asks us. Maybe I want to put it as a question: is Jesus still disturbing the peace? Is the real Jesus the one who disturbs the comfort and complacency of the cultural drift? With that, I think we should formally end the tape, and some of us have some more conversations to continue here, and I think some of us need to go to bed.